May it please the panel, with me today is co-counsel Phil Parrott, and also the appellant defendant Jerry Ray is present with us. And with the court's permission, I would like to address the issues of prosecutorial misconduct generally, and if there are questions regarding the merger issue, Mr. Parrott is prepared to address those, answer for those questions to the panel. This case, the backdrop of this case was over a three-year period of time prior to trial, there were 48 news stories in newspapers, television, and radio regarding publicity about the investigation in Adams County into public corruption. The news coverage was constant and pervasive during that time period. The dominant themes were public corruption and allegations of payments to public officials. These news reports contained and regularly accused Mr. Ray and his company Quality Paving of having been involved in public corruption and payments to public officials. Most importantly, 4 months before trial, the Adams County Board of County Commissioners conducted a survey of the Adams County voters and found that 84% of the Adams County voters were very concerned about public corruption. This was and became a case of win at all costs for the district attorney's office. There was tremendous political pressure on the office and on the Board of County Commissioners. Interestingly, no, there was no evidence of public corruption by Mr. Ray, and he was not charged with public corruption.
You're using that term essentially to connote bribery.
A direct corruption of a public official involving the public official, I think, is how it would be commonly understood by most people. Certainly, that's how it was presented by the prosecutors in this case.
It's contrasted with defrauding the public official by misrepresentation.
Exactly. In this case, there were three invoices, fraudulent invoices, that were prepared by a former employee whose mother owned part of the company. There was no evidence of any participation by any of the public officials as part of those fraudulent invoices. It's important to note that immediately before this trial was the trial of Dennis Cohen, who worked at Quality Paving. He was the foreman or the chief operating officer of the company. And in that trial, which I attended, during the closing argument, the same two prosecutors, in this case David Young, who's now the sitting district attorney, told the jury in closing, "We knew commissioners were paid off, but we couldn't prove it." I raised that to the court prior to voir dire in our trial, which started immediately after that trial.
Yeah, excuse me, I have a question about that. I know you quoted it in the reply brief, as we know there were payments under the table, which would, I think, be highly improper if it implied that the prosecution had evidence that it wasn't giving the jury. But when I looked at the record, it seemed more softly stated than that.
Well, first, the Dennis Cohen case, the quote was, "They knew commissioners were paid off, but they couldn't prove it."
That was in the other case?
Yes.
Okay.
The phrases that he used in our case were he said,
if something was given to them under the table, we can't prove that.
Right. They were good at what they did.
That's a little softer than the statement in the other case.
Well, it may be softer, but when you consider the context of it, it started in voir dire where I objected, even after I advised him in front of the court before we started. They got up and started questioning jurors in voir dire about public corruption. Then they went to opening statements, and Jess Redmond, the other very experienced senior prosecutor, had a theme of public corruption throughout his entire opening. Keep in mind, there was no evidence at trial ever presented of any public corruption or payoff to public officials. Then in closing, Mr. Redmond, in his initial closing, said that the use of public office for gain, that would not be submitting a fraudulent invoice. Mr. Young's rebuttal was, continue the theme of public corruption and payments under the table, to which I objected. And after the objection, Mr. Young continued to talk about payments and corruption. There's other instances. They described our expert as a hired gun. They referred to using the money for taxpayers for other purposes. And Mr. Young, in my view, expressed the opinion that he's guilty. Judge Shin, who, by the way, was an excellent trial judge, felt that that was a softer comment. That was my interpretation. What's really important, though, is that after trial and based upon our motions, the judge found that we had raised the motions in limine before trial, in request of the court before voir dire, objections during trial, that we didn't waive them, and that they were not invited by the defendant, clearly establishing a de novo review by this panel. Most importantly, and I'm sorry to quote because I know we're limited on time, Judge Shin found, "The record is replete with comments made by the prosecution at virtually every phase of the trial, from jury selection to closing, using either exact term public corruption or words so closely related thereto that they have no distinction or pick a unit." He found there was not one scintilla of direct evidence of payment by a Ray to any public official, and found that this was not proper and not supported by the evidence. Talk about People versus Walter. Here's really the crux of this issue. Judge Chin lives in Sterling, Colorado. He was not present in Adams County or the Denver area when these newspapers appeared in the Denver Post and on all the news stations and on all the radio stations and the local newspapers in Adams County. He wasn't aware of the survey that appeared in the Denver Post with 84% of the voters considered public corruption to be an important case. And therein lies the problem. He didn't consider the totality of all of the circumstances given the backdrop of that media. Now, the prosecutor...
Well, excuse me. How much... You say he wasn't aware of it because he lived in Sterling. No matter where he lived, it would be incumbent on you to make him aware of this. Did you do so in your motion for a new trial?
Well, we did that in the motion in limine in the very beginning, which the court granted and said there'd be no comments about public corruption or bribery or payment to public...
And in that motion, you referred to the history of press coverage.
Yes.
And the survey.
No, the survey was brought up to the judge. I don't remember the first time it was brought up to the judge. I just don't recall. I can tell you this, that it was given to the court with the 48 news articles. We literally handed it to Judge Shin, and contained in that was the newspaper article with talking about the survey of the Adams County voters. Now, I don't know what Judge Shin did know or didn't know. Very knowledgeable guy, and I assume he reads the Denver Post. I don't think that's the same thing as being in Adams County, where this news coverage was so pervasive and so knowledgeable. And it wasn't just this case. There was also a case about the auditor, I think the tax assessor. A lot of this was all going on at the same time. Here's what I know is, against that backdrop, these very seasoned, experienced prosecutors, this wasn't a case of a prosecutor getting carried away in closing argument. Not like the Munoz case where the prosecutor referred to drug cartels, Mexican drug cartels, where there was no evidence of that. This was a calculated effort by these two prosecutors, one of whom was going to be running for district attorney and is now the sitting district attorney, to win at all costs. This was a calculated decision to inject public corruption at every stage of the trial when they knew that they had no evidence of that. It was deliberate. And it was done in the light of we were objecting even before trial and trying to prevent this, yet they continued to inject it in trial. I believe that if Judge Shin had considered the total impact of this news coverage and the public corruption, I believe that his decision would have been different. And that's what we're appealing to you for, is to consider the totality of all of those circumstances. Now, I realize that the burden here is to show that there's no reasonable possibility that it didn't affect the trial. Well, here's my best argument for that. Prosecutors thought it was going to affect the trial, because that's why they did what they did. They did it over our objections before and during trial, and even after trial. I mean, they continually structured this trial to talk about public corruption, and they had no evidence of any public corruption, no payments to any public officials, no influencing public officials, nothing. They had evidence of a few meetings with a couple of county officials in this array, and that was it. The other thing that's notably absent from the state and the prosecution's brief is there's no discussion about how strong the evidence was, and there's a reason for that. It was because there was very little actual evidence. What they had was one disgruntled employee who had been fired, who prepared three fraudulent invoices, and his mother was a part owner of the company. He received a plea deal in which he pled guilty to a felony and a misdemeanor, and the felony has now been dismissed based upon his cooperation at trial. That was the evidence. There was no other evidence of any direct involvement by Mr. Ray in either the preparation of the invoices or the dealing with the county officials. So there was very little real evidence here that linked Mr. Ray to submitting the invoices. But when you put it in the context and the backdrop of this public corruption issue and talking about public corruption continually during the trial, that's where things begin. And keep in mind that there had been two trials before his trial, Mr. Cohen and also one of the public officials, the inspector who pled guilty, and Mr. Cohen was found guilty at trial of being involved. And by the way, it was a separate company, but also dealing with Adams County, not this set of facts with Quality Paving. And so there had been two trials before. There were two cases brought afterwards. So in Adams County at this time, it was pervasive, these allegations of public corruption. Alice Nichols, the city commissioner, allegations that there was work done at her house, none of which was there any evidence of any of this in this case. And it was against that backdrop that these very experienced prosecutors knew exactly what they were doing when they appealed to the jury for public corruption. I see that I've got a few minutes left, and I don't know if the panel has questions about the merger issue.
I do have a question about the merger issue, actually.
Well, let me just, if I could say one thing, and then I'll let Mr. Perry address your question.
Okay.
That was nothing more than a continuation of their theme of win at all costs. They knew, and the law was clear, it was improper to wrap up all, to allege all those different fraud counts when they all occurred within the same 6 month period of time. That really was part of the overall scheme here to win at all costs. And I'll let Mr. Perry address.
Well, let me, I have one question before you leave.
Yes, sir.
You alluded to de novo review earlier in your argument.
Yes, sir.
Aren't we reviewing for an abuse of discretion in terms of the lower court's denial of your post-trial motion?
I don't think so, and here's why. Judge Shin carefully considered our motion. He left Mr. Ray out on bail pending this appeal. I believe that he thinks that there is some chance that this will get reversed and remanded. And he, in my view, really teed this up for the panel and found that it should be a de novo review.
How? I'm not understanding. I mean, he finds prosecutorial misconduct.
Yes, sir.
He finds you preserved it. But then he essentially finds it's harmless error because of other charges and some testimony. How are we reviewing that de novo?
He found that we had raised the issues and motions in limine, statements from the Cohen trial during voir dire, objections during trial, and said that he believed that it was timely and not invited, and therefore it should be reviewed de novo.
Well, that doesn't, I mean, what he says doesn't affect the law. I mean, discretionary review of post-trial motion.
I guess my answer is the record before you, I think, establishes that it should be reviewed de novo. We make that request.
Thank you.
Good morning, Phil Perry. Yes.
Good morning. Here's my question for you in terms of a multiplicity. To me, there's a tension here between the discretion that goes to the prosecutor and how it pleads its case, and a double jeopardy concerns on the back end. Why isn't it sufficient that we cure the double jeopardy concerns with a merger at the end?
This case is different than those involving the cure, and for this reason, almost every case says the cure is not just dismissal where there is some trial-related prejudice, and I think in this case, that is that case. There's a couple things. First, in this case, unlike virtually almost all except King, the cases the people cite, this defendant objected to the multiplicity charges throughout three times. That's number one. And under the Benavia case, which I cite, the federal court even acknowledges where the defendant objects, then the trial court has a duty then to look at it. Second, here there is, this is where these charges were literally some cases street by street by street. And the key thing I'd like you to think about is the unit of prosecution. That's why it's not sufficient. In every case that the people cite, the unit of prosecution was not violated. They weren't really multiplicity charges from the beginning. Here, clearly, under the law, the unit of prosecution is 6 months. And the charges violated that unit of prosecution, and that's what brings us to the double jeopardy.
Go ahead.
All right, but I'm not sure that answers Judge Ramon's question. Maybe I seem to interrupt him, for which I apologize. Even if it's a unit of prosecution problem, if by merger the convictions are reduced to the proper unit of prosecution, i.e. one charge, then where is the reversible error?
The error is in submitting the multiplicitous charges over the defendant's objection to the jury in this case.
Okay, maybe I ask for a question. Where is the harm that has not been rectified by merger down to the appropriate level of prosecution?
The harm is the conviction itself.
Because?
Because by improperly dividing the unit of prosecution the way they did in a street-by-street basis, it gave a roadmap to the jury in an impermissible way that could lead to the conviction without the jury considering, it allowed the jury, as I think I said, to convict based on the trees instead of the forest and see the whole thing. The whole defense was a 6 month, this is a 6 month period of time, look what happened over the 6 months. By dividing it, the prejudice to Mr. Reyes that allowed them, instead of doing that, which was the law, to look street by street by street and cumulatively come to a conviction decision.
Do you agree that the same, more or less the same evidence would have come in, even though it might have been presented in a different way?
The same cumulative amount of evidence would have come in, okay. But yes, sir, in a different way, a very different way.
You're not asserting that the evidence was insufficient to support one conviction for theft and one conviction for conspiracy?
I am. I have not raised that.
Okay, that's my point. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, bar number 40978 on behalf of the people. I think I'd like to start with the multiplicity issue, since that's where we just ended. This is not a double jeopardy issue. There is no double jeopardy issue on appeal, because through post-verdict merger, as our Supreme Court did in Lucero and as the U.S. Supreme Court did in Ball, that is the correct remedy for if there's a multiplicitous verdict and we have a single unit of prosecution. In order for it to be a double jeopardy violation, he would have to have essentially gotten multiple convictions and multiple punishments for the same criminal conduct. Here, it was merged into a single charge of theft, a single charge of conspiracy. Judge Roman?
But assuming what you say is correct, why don't we have a prejudice issue that we still have to deal with, in the sense that the way it was pled, it looks like there's 20 counts. But when you take into account the multiplicity, then it looks like 4 counts. From a jury standpoint, it's pretty easy to compromise a verdict with 20 counts. Something's got to stick. Something's got to be right, doesn't it? Why doesn't the 11th Circuit, or the 8th Circuit, whichever it was in the Bonavita case, have it right in terms of the approach? If they bring it to the court's attention before it's submitted to the jury, then the trial court must analyze it and must then take out the cases that are duplicative, or the counts that are duplicative. And if they don't bring it to his attention ahead of time, then it gets merged on the back end. Isn't that a good rule?
All of this comes from sort of the due process concern from Justice Stevens' concurrence in Ball. And there is that concern, but I disagree that that's the only case that dealt with where there was a pretrial motion. The McCafferty case in the Sixth Circuit, there was a pretrial motion. That's more sort of the most parallel situation to our case. Same scenario. There were 10 counts of making false statements to FBI agents based on a single statute, based on a single 90-minute conversation the person had. And the McCafferty case said the correct solution here is post-verdict merger. Yes, there was a pretrial motion. Yes, there is this possibility. But it's not, there's no possibility of actual prejudice here where the exact same evidence would have been presented and the jury was specifically instructed to consider each charge separately. The same thing happened in Matthews, the Ninth Circuit. There was a pretrial motion, 3 counts of PowPo based on a single incident in which the offender had 3 different weapons. And post-trial merger was correct, same reason, same evidence would have been presented. And this case is not the special case. There was no compromise verdict, which was the concern Justice Stevens stated in Ball. There is no possibility that some of the evidence wouldn't have been presented and some of it would have. There was no lack of instruction to the jury about you have to separately consider, you have to analyze each one of these counts separately. And given the amount of time the jury spent deliberating after this 4-week trial involving a lot of complex issues, the battle of the experts, there's nothing here to suggest that they were simply overwhelmed by the fact there were 10 counts and convicted based on just the number of counts as opposed to having found him guilty, having analyzed them. And there's no basis to presume the jury just ignored the instruction. Now, defense counsel in his reply brought up unpublished decision from Western Washington that said, that had this scenario, that happened procedurally in the trial, and it was dealt with that way. That decision appears to be incorrect. And what's more, once we have a jury, it was done before there was a jury verdict. Once we have a jury verdict, the question is whether that should be cast aside and a new trial should be granted, or if the proper remedy is, as every single federal circuit has held, to post-verdict merge the offenses, ensure that he only gets a single conviction, ensure that he only gets a single sentence. Now, I've researched this a lot, and I don't mean to ambush, but something that came up in my research after the briefing was complete was a case called U.S. v. Polizzi. That's a 393 Fed Appendix 784. And that's a Second Circuit case where the trial court, in a published trial decision out of New York, decided to actually, it thought it was the special case. It did say, we grant a new trial. And the Second Circuit reversed it, finding it was an abuse of discretion to vacate a jury verdict and order a new trial because the same evidence and issues would have been presented regardless of how charged. So I'm going to turn to the prosecutorial misconduct issue. First, I'd like to point out what this case is not. It's not an appeal of the denial of a change of venue based on publicity. There's nothing in the record about where the trial judge actually lived. What we do know is that the trial judge sat through this entire four-week trial, including an extensive jury questionnaire and voir dire procedure. It was done specifically to address pre-trial publicity issues. And the defense counsel admitted, you did everything you possibly could to address this issue. But now, on appeal, is claiming it wasn't enough. With regard to public corruption, that term did come up throughout trial. It's a little difficult because there are no citations in the argument section of the defendant's brief to determine exactly where he claims to have preserved this, but I did go through and find each and every place in which he's referencing in his statement of the case. Motion in limine discussed on July 11th, 2011 at the hearing. There was a discussion specifically regarding testimony about work being done on an official's house or about specific gifts. That was the only issue that was sort of preserved there, not a general statement of there should be no, the words public corruption shouldn't come up. During voir dire, defense counsel made arguments about public publicity, but the trial court didn't make any ruling specifically.
You said public publicity. Did you mean public corruption?
Yes, I did. Pre-trial publicity and suggesting a single comment about corruption would trigger a need for a mistrial. That was the argument he's citing to, his own argument. There was no real ruling made based on that.
Well, are you disputing that this issue is properly preserved or not?
I am disputing that it's properly preserved, despite the trial court's decision. Really, I think the interesting part I'm getting into the forest instead of the trees, is what the proper review standard should be here. Because in this case, unlike the usual case we see with claims of prosecutorial misconduct, here there was a post-trial motion where the trial court itself conducted what we usually see, the two-step analysis. Was this a potentially improper thing, and did it cause any actual prejudice? Because it conducted both of those steps, and because our Supreme Court case law says very distinctly that the trial court is the one in the best position to assess whether these instances of misconduct actually affected the trial, actually could have affected the verdict, that I think the entirety of the claim should be reviewed for abuse of discretion.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. Let's say that they raise the claim, it's just a simple prosecutorial misconduct argument that we see every day, without referencing the motion to new trial, and said to the extent that things weren't objected to with a contemporaneous objection that it would be reviewed under plain error, then they would give benefit of a better standard of review than abuse of discretion?
I think that by filing the post-trial motion and trying to resolve the issue with the court best able to resolve it, that is why additional deference should be given here. If no post-trial motion had been filed, and then we would consider these things and consider preservation issues directly.
But they can't just raise the claim as a straight prosecutorial misconduct argument on appeal? Just raise it that way and get the benefit of a better standard of review? I'm confused by their choice to try to get the trial court to grant a motion to new trial. Suddenly they've shoved themselves into poorer standard of review land on appeal.
I understand the concern. I think that it was a strategic decision that defense counsel had to make at the close of trial. Did he think that presenting these claims of prosecutorial misconduct to the trial judge who'd been there and seen it, did they think that was the better option for trying to present these claims and find some possibility of there actually being some finding of error, as opposed to coming from a cold record here to the Court of Appeals without having specific rulings from the trial court on each of these issues, and then having to deal with the question of preservation, plain error versus harmless error, because the trial court didn't actually, while conducting the two-step review, didn't actually conduct it quite exactly correctly, because there are issues with the preservation of the public corruption. For example, defense counsel started his closing argument by stating, prosecution's been talking about public corruption throughout this trial. Where's the public corruption case? They haven't proven it. There's no evidence of that. That was a decision made to attack that theme that the prosecution had been run. It wasn't all of a sudden we've been ambushed by this or we've been prejudiced by it coming up throughout trial. It was something they used for themselves, part of their vehicle.
Well, what choice did they have at that point? If there had been many prior references by the prosecution to public corruption?
There had been prior references. The only ones that I found in the opening brief came up at voir dire. The only one that was objected to was when the prosecution was asking the jury about fraud versus corruption, and there was an objection overruled that's not improper voir dire. We're just trying to figure out what people know at this point. There wasn't anything else he pointed to except for the opening statement and the closing statement. Opening statement, the prosecution, right after the prosecution discussed corrupt relationships is a big part of this case. There was no objection made. During closing argument, the prosecution discussed the difference between fraud and corruption immediately after having discussed the improper influence of public official charges, and there was no objection made to that. The only objection made during closing argument to the four other items was to the under the table comment, and that was overruled, but there was a corrective instruction given to the jury. The objection was that's facts based on facts not evidence. Overruled, but the jury, you're instructed, this is argument, you are to judge what the evidence of the trial showed. The other issues, the hired gun, the taxpayer money spent elsewhere, the personal opinion of guilt by the prosecutor, there were no objections made to any of those things on closing argument. If this court were to conduct its usual two-step review instead of giving additional deference because we're dealing with motion for new trial, those would all be reviewed for plain error. They could only be overturned if they are flagrantly incorrect or improper, and they're not. And not only that, the trial court itself, again, best able to judge the situation, found that they were harmless errors at most. There are no further questions. I ask this court to affirm the judgments below. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue written opinion in due course when the tables are.